Do you know what time it is? It's supernatural story time. And if you're easily scared, and even if you're not, there's only one thing left to do. Just turn off the lights, because these are stories that you listen to only in the dark. The Hidden Room. I'll try to remember as much detail as I can, but I doubt I'll be able to explain how deeply uneasy I felt at the time. My friend and I found a hiding place in an Afghan family's home that we never figured out. I was the medic in a platoon-sized strike force with both U.S. Army and Afghan infantry. We went on hastily planned missions, almost exclusively at night, and our transportation was usually by MH-47 helicopter. In other words, we were sort of like SWAT, and we captured bad people. Some of our targets had access to explosives and IED booby traps, killed more guys at deployment than anything else. We also searched these dudes' houses, and of course found massive quantities of weapons, explosives, and heroin. Every night we went on a mission, we walked on eggshells and scanned every doorway, rooftop, and window, waiting for the faint hint of a threat and reacting aggressively for even the slightest sign of trouble. Stressful job. I remember the night of this mission being bitterly cold but dry as a bone, with wind that made the already harsh high desert region impossibly more inhospitable. We had a longer than average wait on the airstrip, so we shivered there next to two sleeping helicopters, wait for the intel we needed. The call finally came, and we knew exactly where we'd hit, the house we'd been watching for a while, but hadn't gotten enough solid info on. The area that it was in had a very bad reputation. It was sparsely populated and the locals were not friendly with the Afghan military or police, so the Taliban could make moves there. The helicopters dropped us off a few miles away from the house and even further from the village, hoping not to wake anyone. It was still the dead of night, but we had to walk in fast if we wanted to get a ride back before daylight came. We split into two formations and began snaking our way around some low hills and across big stretches of nothingness. A few dogs barked along the way, but our walk otherwise was all quiet. We passed close by one house along the way, but I remember thinking in a night that dark and windy, the locals would have to have night vision to see us even 100 feet away. We were almost to the house, and the guys in the lead slowed us down a bit because they were spotting more and more potential IEDs on our route. They kept checking them out, finding nothing, and leading us past. But it got to be kind of ominous. There was simply more debris around. The area had been hit with heavy fighting for a while, but this was 2010, probably years after the fighting was over, and most other places we found had been improved. This place still felt like a ghost town. I won't describe the actual raid, but it went off without a hitch, and we found our guy and two women, his wife and her mother. None of them would speak a word to us. With the hard part done, we started searching the place with a vengeance. We'd been looking for this guy a long time, and the Afghan soldiers really wanted to nail him with a serious crime, but he didn't have a weapon or even money on him when he was searched. The three apparently rode in on the same motorcycle and no luggage. At the time, we did not search the women, and all the non-Muslim men were instructed to not even look at the women. These women were fierce, though, definitely angry and defiant, and stared at us from under their burqas as we searched around. The house itself was weird. There was nothing there. It was abandoned-looking. Afghan houses in that part of the country were made of a sort of adobe. Bricks or layers of mud, dung, straw, and cattle were typically kept in rooms adjoining the room where the family slept to maximize warmth. There was almost always a kitchen with ingredients and usually a tool shed or work area where you'd do farm stuff or park a motorcycle. This house had a kitchen, but it was completely bare, and no food on the man or woman either. There were no animals, but there was a barn, also completely bare. The little cubby closet, I assume, was a tool shed, had nothing in it but a hammer and the rusty remnants of a kid's bicycle. Nothing special about it, but the bike sort of captivated me, And I even remember a bit of braided wire twisted around the seat post like a child had made a little decoration out of it. My closest friend in that squad was Joe, a Native American dude who was only 20 or so, very humble, and the only spiritual guy in our strike force other than the Muslims. His dad was Navajo and his mother Cheyenne Arapaho, and he always put war paint on his chest before missions. I noticed that he was pacing back and forth in front of the empty barn, staring at his feet. I walked over to him and wordlessly watched what he was doing. The bedroom is too small. The barn is too small. This house is like 8 feet bigger on the outside as it is on the inside. There's a hidden room. Joe said it pretty casually, but I immediately called it out over the radio, since he didn't have one. A hidden room could mean nothing, or it could mean a lot of explosives connected to a booby trap. We had a guy who was better trained to look for traps and luckily also had a canine, so we started the nerve-wracking task of excavating the wall enough to check the mystery space out. I was the medic and shouldn't have been anywhere near this as it played out, but I was suddenly obsessed with the space. Joe, too. Nobody said anything as we took the lead on it. I grabbed a hammer from nearby and Joe found some rebar. The IED guy said it looked fine, just the mud wall, and the Doug wasn't interested at all. When a senior guy asked the man and woman about it, they still refused to say much, but did say, "It's just an empty room. There's nothing in there." They didn't explain what they were doing in the abandoned place. Joe and I knocked some bricks loose of the wall and got a squarish hole about 1 foot by 1 foot in size right next to the floor. We paused for a little while just looking at it, not wanting to take our eyes off it, not sure what could be just inches inside the total black. He flipped the red lens off his flashlight and shined it in, but the beam was almost useless to see any detail in the dust we had kicked up near the hole. I knelt down and offered to stick my head halfway in to see as much as possible, and was a little shocked to feel the inside of the room was slightly colder than the night air around us. The inside of those adobe houses always seemed magically insulated against the extreme cold, so it was unnerving. Joe seemed to notice it too, but neither of us said anything. I saw literally nothing. It really was like a total blank, dark, empty, 8 foot by 8 foot by 6 foot room. Since we already had a decent hole, it was easy to keep knocking bricks out until we had a hole big enough to slip through. As we chipped at the wall, it felt like the room was exhaling past us or something. I feel very weird just even saying that. Like the feeling rushed back to me. The room whispered as it opened and it was like unsealing an ancient Egyptian tomb. It was compelling, but neither of us said a word. Enough spooky ghost story stuff. The next part is what downright haunts me. Inside the room really was colder somehow. Drafty. Like there was a hole in the wood and mud ceiling, but we didn't see one. The walls were blank except for some drawings in white paint. They were definitely children's drawings, like you'd see on the wall of a fifth grade class. It wasn't a mural, but there were several parts to it, and I did sketch them all down, but I lost the notepad sometime after getting home. The top part was what looked like two crude airplanes or helicopters. The bottom part was a line of stick figures inside a big rectangle, and there were streaks of paint between the two. Joe chuckled. "Hey, looks like some kids with artistic talent really want to shoot our aircraft down. Great fighting spirit." "No, man. Look at the people. Look at the line above them. They're lying down, and none are holding guns. The aircraft are shooting down at them." We stared at the painting for way too long, especially in that bare little room. Suddenly, coming to our senses, we stepped out among the living into the courtyard. The women were both sitting on the ground motionless, laser-focused, facing us. I've never felt such an intense gaze from eyes I couldn't even see. Joe muttered to me that he felt like he needed to cleanse himself after being in the room, and he finished looking through the barn and sang one of his traditional songs to himself. I didn't know what to do, but I really wanted to get out of there. I could feel such a deep hate coming from those women. We packed up and moved out, going a different direction than we came from. We arrested the man and we were going to leave the women at a nearby police checkpoint since they couldn't be out alone. As we walked out past the house, our path led directly into a graveyard. A sense of dread filled me while I walked through that graveyard, staring at the ground, careful not to step on any headstones or little piles of rocks. I realized what the lines in the drawing meant. Those stick figures were bodies lined up within the borders of the graveyard that was just a 30-second walk up the trail. It was one of the heaviest feelings I felt in my career. The feeling started to fade after the helicopters took off. Faded a little more when they dropped us off and we cleaned up and grabbed some chow before the debriefing. I brought up during the debriefing and nobody had any clue what the room was for or who sealed it up like that. Not even the experienced guys had ever seen anything like it, or even a kid's drawing with people in it, generally not okay in Islam. The heavy feeling stuck around for a few nights and faded more as time went on, but it never did fade away completely. I feel it again right now. 4:30 a.m. now. Hopefully you guys sleep better than I do tonight. The time slip. I suppose I should tell you this story. I promise you every written word here is completely true, though it may seem slightly impossible to imagine. I will describe every detail I can. This is the story of how I committed my first large crime and got away with it. It was June of 2010 when my wife divorced me. She took with her all of my kids and all of my money. I was left homeless. The day after June 2nd, a buddy called me. He told me he was low on money himself and that he needed some help. Upon explaining my financial situation to him, he called our other pal. The other pal, I'll call him Michael, was never very rich. He couldn't support both of us due to his lack of money himself. So we came up with an idea. We'd rob a bank. Michael happened to be big on guns and owned numerous weapons, which might explain his lack of money. Anyway, we had spent the next 4 nights hatching a plan to rob this bank. 3 mid-20 guys aren't exactly fit to rob a somewhat heavily secured bank. We bought masks first. Clowns was the theme we went with, and then ammo. Luckily, my first friend, who I'll call Alan from here on, already rode around a cheap van, which was perfect as our getaway vehicle. Michael pulled some strings, did some intimidating to get someone to investigate cameras and patrol patterns under the guise of an exterminator. After we mapped that out, it was time to go. June 6, 2010, 9 p.m. We pulled into the garage of the bank, where a few guards were sitting, loitering about. Michael took one by surprise, telling the other two to get down or he would shoot their friend. They did as they were told, throwing their weapons towards us. We zip-tied their hands and moved into the building, masks on at this point. I remember those masks being really stuffy and hot. We moved quietly, threading our way around guards and cameras. I remember Alan almost tripping up at one point, causing a guard to come find us. In the end, we made it to the safe, where we were trying to get into. Alan cracked it, and we got the money. This was when things got unusual. We had the money in duffel bags, tied to our backs, and we were making our way out when a guard saw us. He had pulled his gun on us, and nearby guards did the same. They didn't take any chances. They shot at Alan first, and I remember the blood flying from his right shoulder onto the wall in an artistic pattern. Then they hit Michael in his chest. The blood from that wound hit the carpet, staining it. I had begun to shoot back at this point and almost made it behind a wall when a bullet hit me square in the forehead. I remember the sharp pain entering my skull and piercing every other sense I had. It only lasted for about 5 seconds, then I felt nothing. I got up and peeked out from the wall. The guards were all standing completely still, frozen mid-motion. Alan had gotten up at this point, too, along with Michael. They said they didn't feel a thing, though the blood was still pouring from their wounds. Alan walked up to a guard and touched his shoulder. Nothing. So we grabbed the money and ran. Upon leaving, I felt the sharp pain in my skull and recoiled in pain, right as we left the perimeter of the building. Alan and Michael both screamed in pain as well and almost crashed the car. The pain lasted for 5 seconds again. We got home, hid the money, and went to sleep. When we awoke, the money was gone. We had all started to scream at each other for taking the cash. I remember the shock when we didn't see a thing about it on the news in the morning. I remember driving by the bank that we had just been shot at the night before and seeing nothing but empty space where the wood structure of an in-construction building sat at. I remember asking everyone if there had been a bank there, only to be told no. But what I specifically remember is the pain that entered my skull and the scar that sits there, perfectly matching the pattern of a bullet wound. Glimpses in the twilight. I've always loved winter, so growing up in Michigan was amazing. Every year I was guaranteed to see snowfall. My parents hated it. My dad definitely didn't want to go out to shovel the snow, and neither did I. It was laborious work. My parents always chose to take family trips around the winter out to California or just any place warm in general. We'd always stay at home for Christmas, though. I hated those trips out to California. I missed getting to build snowmen and having snowball fights with my friends. It was my sophomore year of college at the University of Minnesota. I arrived home the second week of December. At the door, I was greeted by my younger brother, Derek, who at the time was a junior in high school, and my father. My mom died when Derek was about a year old, so neither of us really got to know her. My dad filled that void, though. I wouldn't trade my dad for anything. The first thing my dad told me after I had gotten settled in was that in 2 days a big snowstorm would be rolling through, the worst anyone had seen in years. I already knew this, of course. I had checked the forecast for the week before coming home, just out of curiosity. In addition to this, my brother was having three of his friends over. Winter break had just started for him as well. My brother and I never had as strong of a bond that I wanted. I guess it's because we just have drastically different personalities. My brother's outgoing, whereas I'm generally pretty reserved. I've always had a small group of friends. The three of us even went to the same college. My brother, on the other hand, was popular in high school. He played on the lacrosse team, was the student vice president 2 years in a row, and was runner-up for freshman homecoming king. The two friends my brother was having over were two of his lacrosse teammates. They are the biggest pricks I think I've ever met. It was Thursday afternoon. I was up in my room on the phone with a friend while my brother and his friends were playing video games downstairs. At 5 in the evening, snowfall clouded the windows of our house and the wind held outside. At 5:30 p.m., the power went out. My brother and his friends all collectively groaned. My dad had been at work when the power first went out. He gave me a call and let me know he'd be working late and didn't know when he'd be home. He's an electrician that works for the city, so he'd be out trying to restore power to the area. I asked him how long he assumed it would take to bring the power back, and he assured me it'd take no longer than maybe an hour. Derek and his friends helped me search the house for flashlights and candles. We threw 2 wood logs in the fireplace and lit it ablaze. The 4 of us gathered by the fire. One of Derek's friends, Marcus, wouldn't shut up about how spooky it was. The living room we sat in was well illuminated by the fire and the candles we set up nearby, but everywhere else in the house was pitch black. It seemed as though there was an endless black void around us. I sat in silence while Derek and his friends complained about how long the power was out. At about 6:30, I got a call from my dad. The reception was spotty, but I could still make out most of what he said. He told me that'd be a long time before the power was back on. He and his co-workers had no idea what was causing the outage and were going through any scenario they felt was plausible, yet nothing seemed to work. The whole county and the 2 neighboring us were out of power. When I told Derek and his friends this, they all let out a loud groan. It was about 8:30 p.m. I tried calling my dad, but couldn't get a signal. I decided to get up from the floor in front of the fire and look outside. Derek and his friends chatted away about school drama and didn't care to see me leave. Outside, the snow still fell, the ground covered in a thick white blanket. I noticed something peculiar, though. About 20 yards from the window, there was footprints. They came from what most likely was the sidewalk and made their way over to the side of the house, right to where the window I looked out of was. The final set of footprints was pointed directly at the window, and then they stopped. They didn't continue, and it didn't look like whoever had walked over had gone back over their steps. They simply stopped while facing the window and disappeared. I just stared at the footsteps, completely perplexed by them. That's when Marcus came up to me. "Hey, what are you doing?" he asked. I looked at him and gestured to the footprints outside. He too just stared at them, confused. At the time, I figured it was probably nothing. I began to walk away from the window when another footprint appeared in the snow, then another. Something was walking up to the window, but whatever it was, I couldn't see it. Marcus gave me a look of confusion and terror. The footsteps stopped once again, about 10 feet from the window. "Hey, sir, I need some help," a voice called out. I was completely frozen. I didn't know what to do. My mind simply couldn't wrap my head around what I was hearing. It sounded like it was coming from outside, but no one was out there. "Please, I'm hurt. My leg, I think it's broken," the voice pleaded. It sounded like a man. He was probably older than me, but there was no physical evidence to go off of. "Could I come inside? It's freezing out here." Marcus, too, stood frozen next to me. From the look on his face, it looked like he was about to shit himself. Derek and his other friend, Jacob, came up behind me. "Who is that?" Derek asked. Marcus pointed out the window. "Are you all just gonna fucking stand out there?" the voice shouted. The set of footprints ran up till they were only a foot away. There was a pound on the glass and all of us jumped back. "I'm hurt, and all you do is stand there?" he shouted. Derek opened his mouth to say something, but nothing came out. I decided to break the silence. What happened to you?" I stammered. "My car. I was trying to drive through the blizzard. Something bit me. Then I swerved off the road and hit a tree." The voice seemed calmer. "Please, just let me in. My phone is busted, and this was the first house I saw that had lights on." He started to cry. At this point, I didn't know what to say. I just go the fuck away." Marcus struggled to get the words out. Everyone in the room turned to Marcus. We all looked at him as if he'd just gone insane. "Fuck you," the voice shouted. There was another pound on the glass. "Let me the fuck in, assholes." "Okay, let's calm." I was cut off by the voice. "Fucking assholes," he shouted. The pounding on the glass was incessant. The man kept shouting for us to let him in. We backed away from the glass and took off. I ran to make sure all the doors were locked while Derek and his friends hid upstairs. They were losing their shit, to say the least. After a minute, the pounding ceased. I stood by the front door, waiting to see if whoever was out there would try to bust down the door. But nothing happened. Everything was silent. Derek and his friend stood atop the stairs. Is he gone?" Derek whispered. I simply shrugged in response. I thought about checking the windows, but I just stood there. The four of us remained upstairs for the night. The power didn't come back till about 2 a.m. When my dad came home, Derek didn't hesitate to tell him about what happened. After Derek finished his story, my dad told us that on his way home, he saw 2 cop cars and an ambulance at the site of an accident about a block away. Some guy had swerved off the road and crashed into a tree. However, his body wasn't found in his car. His body was found about a day later. 2 of his major arteries had been severed. Someone or something had bit him twice, once severing his jugular, the other severing an artery in his leg. He was completely drained of blood. What happened on Avery Street? File contents. December 4th, 2009. James E. Parker, 17 years. Richard Lou Marcus, 19 years. Helen Green, 17 years. And Barbara Holmes, 16 years, left school at exactly 4:57 p.m. These 4 teenagers were reported to have last been seen headed in the general direction of Harbor Field. On December 6, 2009, phone calls from all said teenagers were received and responded to. The calls all reported that their children had not been home in 2 days, which was out of their normal behavior. Police arrived at the 4 homes and acted an ordinance of Missing Persons Act and began to search for the 4 teenagers. A search was conducted extending from their school to Harbor Field itself. None of the missing were located during the search. Police issued an Amber Alert once more for the 4 children. However, there were no new leads brought forth. February 2, 2010. A man named Weasley Connor called into the station reporting to authorities that he had seen Barbara Holmes, 16 years of age, wandering the street, and that he was currently on his way to the nearest hospital to have her submitted for large gashes on both her left wrist and the lower left portion of her neck. Police notified her parents and arrived at the medical center roughly 8 minutes later. Officers found what was described as a stereotype used for how one would envision a mental asylum patient. The doctors were eventually able to sedate Barbara Holmes with the aid of authorities. The cause of her meltdown in the hospital care is still unknown. When the medical staff managed to stitch her wounds, they reported to police that the cuts were far too deep and seemed to have been ripped into for it to have been an accident or stabbing. They stated that it was also not likely to have been self-inflicted. Authorities remained on site. During the night of March 14th, police were notified by a hospital that they had found Richard Lou Marcus, 19 years of age, during a response call to a man lying on the sidewalk covered in blood. Richard Marcus's family was notified of his discovery and were already at the hospital when police arrived to be notified that he had bled out before they got him to the emergency room shortly before they arrived. His body had been sent to autopsy. 3 weeks after the death of Richard Lou Marcus, a 911 call was made from Harbor Field by someone claiming to be Helen Green, 17 years of age. The dispatcher reported that she could hear a male screaming in the background and something screaming in the distance. However, she was unable to identify what could have made the noise. Officers were sent to the site that the call had been traced to during the call, which lasted for a minute and 39 seconds. When the police arrived on the scene, they found no landline. Officials are investigating into how a landline was traced to the location, but so far no results have been yielded. There was a single report by an officer on the scene saying that he heard a woman scream in the general area that they had been searching after discovering no telephone. On June 13, 2010, a letter was received at the police station written using cutouts on a dirty gray crumpled sheet of paper. The message read as follows. There were four for fear, but they shriveled to one in here. Please send us more, for this we shall endure. The deaths of few lead to the strength of plenty. Pray to us, and you will witness the darkest entity. The envelope was noticed to have a bulge, which, when turned upside down, dropped a human finger onto the tiled floor. Forensics found it belonged to James E. Parker, 17 years of age. The Ghost Hunter's Journal. I found the journal of a ghost hunter in the supply closet at work. It documents the cases he worked on in 2009. It reads, this diary belongs to John Doe. I will be using this name from here onwards for the sake of protecting the author's privacy. Below this is a small space for the author's signature, but it appears to have been scratched out with a thick pointed black pen. On the top right corner of the page is a crudely drawn eye with three upside down pyramids attached to the lower lid. Also noteworthy is the word Lenore. Writing is illegible and not that of John's, which appears on the pages several times. Entry number 1, dated February 2, 2009. You don't know true fear until you've walked Euclid's Trail in the middle of the night with nothing but a flashlight. Jacob, the local librarian, strongly believes that the place is haunted, even possessed, and should one choose to drive out there after dark, one would see and hear some strange things, in his words. Question is, do I take this on? I have seen things in my life that I have no plausible explanation for, but they ultimately push me to become what I am today. If there is one thing I have learned from all these years, it is this. You can never be sure of anything until you've seen it yourself. It might seem like the obvious truth, but you'd be surprised at just how much it is overlooked. My point is that even the most ridiculous urban legends have a grain of truth to them, and it is this I am after. I did a quick internet search on haunted Euclid, Ohio, but nothing directly related came up. A few rumors of hauntings here and there, but that was about it. I did find an interesting video on a blog titled Lenore about an abandoned hospital in Euclid. Strange thing is that when the only post on the entire site, nothing else. I burned it to a CD to make sure I have it on me at all times for reference. Entry number 2, April 2nd, 2009. I did it. Almost, anyway. I've decided to walk through the woods instead of driving out there so I could get the most out of the experience. But I was still a significant distance away from the I-90 overpass and the actual trail, so I got into my car at about 8 p.m. after having a light dinner and drove two-thirds of the way through Euclid Avenue before cutting onto the I-90. The place was fairly quiet, not much activity on the roads or the common areas I drove by. I reasoned that the locals probably were a similar lot and preferred keeping to themselves. I ran out of gas about a half hour into I-90, worried that I'd have to cut my investigation short before it even began. Thankfully, there was a station a little further ahead, and I figured I'd ask the employees around for an inside scoop about the trail. The first person I interviewed was the pump operator, a young man in his early 20s. I pulled out my voice recorder and began talking. I informed him that I was investigating a haunted trail that was around there and looking for more information about its origins and the place it held in the culture of Euclid currently. He looked away for a second, adjusted his cap, and folded his hands across his chest. He then pinpointed the exact location on the map that was resting on my steering wheel and asked me if it was there I was heading. I nodded my head. His face turned grim right then. He was quiet for a few minutes, and then he told me to turn my car around and go back to where I'd come from. I was a little taken aback by his attitude, but not surprised. I assured him that I would take his advice, only if he'd tell me more about the trail. He seemed to believe me. Euclid's trail housed the remains of a Civil War insane asylum in a children's hospital. As the story went, sometime in the late 1800s, the hospital broke out in flames, taking the lives of many children and soldiers. The woods around the fire pit was where the reported hauntings took place. There was also a large brick bridge somewhere in the forest, dating back to the early 1500s. It was said that after the fire in the hospital, the children who escaped got lost in the woods and had no way to survive. Believing that they were miles away from civilization, they entered into a suicide pact. One by one, they hung themselves off the side of the bridge. He also asserted firmly that the police patrolled the area at nights and usually levied a heavy fine on trespassers. I thanked him for his help, paid the money, and turned my car back onto the road. Ben knew that I wasn't going to take his warning seriously after all, judging by the sigh he gave when I took one last look at him. I found the trail a few minutes later. Unfortunately for me, the police were present there and I couldn't go in until they dispersed. So here I am instead, sitting in the car, making an entry in my diary. Time, 11:39 p.m. I don't think they'll be staying here for the rest of the night. Time, 3:58 a.m. I am sitting in the waiting room as I write this. I am not leaving until they find that boy. The trail was not all that frightening, but the noises, they sounded like Elise. It's all in my head. I know this. But when you're in there, it feels so real. And the boy, Frederick, he ran away before I could ask him what he was doing in the woods. I called the police on it, despite knowing that I would also be fined for being a trespasser. But the child's safety was of much more importance to me. I told him about my encounter with him, leaving out one detail. Right before he disappeared, Frederick said something to me. "Go to Lenore." I don't know what he meant, but I feel compelled to do something about it. There's this weird feeling in my gut. I know somehow that this is important for me. Third entry. Date, September 9th, 2009. Nothing. They told me they patrolled the area every night, but hadn't seen anybody, because they'd made sure that nobody would be in there. I reasoned with them, but it quickly turned into an argument of it was just an animal versus I know what I saw. I'm frustrated. I also keep dreaming about Frederick hurting Elise frequently. Fourth entry, October 9, 2009. I'm going back to Euclid with Andy. I have to find the boy. Fifth entry, date December 9, 2009. We saw Frederick again. This time he was wearing a faded bunny suit. I switched on my recorder and asked him a few questions. He wouldn't answer, just stared at the space between Andy and I. At one point, I could hear Andy sucking in his breath. That's when I realized that he was afraid of Frederick. So was I. I called out to Frederick again. He opened his mouth as if to say something, but his face contorted into a horrible expression. I saw a white figure flick across the trees, and Frederick snapped his head to the right, but it was gone before we could see what it was. There was a spurt of bright white light beside me where Andy was standing. When I looked back, the boy was gone. Andy had taken a photo. There was nobody in the spot where Frederick stood. Maybe he had disappeared before the flash went off. I don't know. Three pages are torn out after this. The CD John talked about was stuck to the back page of the journal with double-sided tape. I will take a look at them and see what they contain. There's more entries, so you should be hearing from me as soon as I finish transcribing after work.
And if I never do or say anything else about what I saw or what I read, it means one of two things. Either I'm dead, or I just realize that I should never, ever, ever talk about that again.